So, tonight we're going to talk about concentration. It is always hard to talk about concentration. It is probably one of the most difficult subjects in the whole Dhamma. I mean, even if we were to talk about non-self, which is a complicated subject in and of itself, everybody would be interested in non-self. But concentration has such a negative kind of connotation in this practice because it creates a way where we have to strive so much and there's so much pressure that gets built up to try to get the mind concentrated that it's just hard to talk about it. It's hard to talk about what's possible. But I want you to be inspired by concentration. I want you to see that even as householders, we need to cultivate concentration. And that it is not, it is not just for young monks and nuns who don't have nothing else to do but sit and practice. That is not the concentration that I think the Buddha was pointing to. I think it's, so I'll give you my take, If it were just about absorption states, deep concentration, that's what those absorption states are. This kind of deep concentration where you're kind of locked in and you can barely move. It's very blissful, very nice. If it was all about that, when the Buddha left home, came up on his first teachers, learned absorption states, he could have stayed there. He could have stayed right there and we'd all be trying to strive for absorption. Oh, wait, that's what we're trying to do anyway. That's right. But he left that. He said, that is not the way. That getting into those absorption states, though they feel pleasurable, that's not it. There's something else that concentration is bringing that I want to talk about. He also tried the whole, that he tried the rough, tough it out, just, stay with your difficulty and bear it. And he tried that too. That didn't work either. So, when he says he did this middle way, what is that? Right? That's what I want to help us see. There is a middle way in concentration that I really got to give props to Philip Moffat because he is the teacher that taught me there is another way to do this. I did not know. My relationship with concentration now is completely different than it was 10, 15 years ago. 10, 15 years ago, the talk I would have given you was bear down, take it, whatever you gotta do, stay there. Thankfully, that person is not giving the talk tonight. So it's gonna be a little bit easier, smoother, something we can all do. Because I was so confused and I misunderstood what we're doing, and it has to do with this English language interpreting, translating Pali words. So concentration, by the nature of that word, it sounds forceful. It sounds like it needs some diligence and strong action. It sounds like it should be hard and take a long time and, shoulders gotta ache and back has to ache, but you gotta stay with it. That's what it sounds like with concentration. But samadhi doesn't sound like that, does it? It sounds softer because it is softer. This concentration that we're trying to cultivate, that we need to try to cultivate, is a softer lift than what we're doing. We're putting way too much pressure on it than need be. And I learned this from starting to study with Philip. And I mean, I just was studying nine bodies with him. That's what I just wanted to learn nine bodies because I loved it and I wanted to learn it. But he had this side practice that he would teach people that he didn't tell us what he was teaching, the meditative practice he was teaching. He just taught us nine bodies. And then gradually we begin to learn there's something else going on here because I could sit comfortably and not panic. I just could just sit with whatever was happening. And I was beginning to learn how to just be in the present moment without a lot of pressure and pushing. And I think that came from what he calls naturally arising samadhi and insight. So he says, samadhi and insight, that's the fruit of that samadhi, it just naturally arises. You don't really have to do anything and concentration naturally comes. So to convince you of this, which I figured you wouldn't believe me because you've all strived for concentration, it doesn't happen. So you're like, no, that's not true. I've tried it and I don't get concentrated. So what, think of this. Have you ever watched a 2-hour movie? Or for some of you, have you ever watched the extended version of Lord of the Rings? I mean, Lord of the Rings is 3 hours anyway, and the extended version adds another half hour, maybe 45 minutes. If you can sit and watch that movie, any movie, how come you can't sit in meditation? What is it that that movie is doing that causes you to be able to sit there for 2 hours and watch it? Or have you ever just watched a sports game? Sit there, watch it. It's a little bit more intricate when it comes to sports. But we can put our attention on something and stay with it. You could stay with preparing a meal. If it took hour and a half, 2 hours, you could prepare the meal, the whole process. Stay with it all the way to the end. That's what concentration is. It's this capacity to stay with something. And this, I remember Rodney one time said, somebody asked him, how much concentration do you need to practice? And he said, enough concentration that if you intend to pick up a piece of paper, that you actually pick it up. That doesn't seem very difficult, that you want to pick up a piece of paper and you pick it up. That's it. That seems pretty easy. So why is this concentration so hard when you try to do it? And it is because the mind, when it's interested in something, will stay there. It will stay and watch and attend to. It will collect and unify around anything that it's interested in. And we are not interested in the present moment. We need to get interested in the present moment, but we are not interested naturally in the present moment. Or I should say, our minds are not interested in the present moment. And this is where the struggle comes in with concentration, because in the present moment, it seems boring. It seems unpleasant. It seems useless, a waste of time. Nothing's actually happening here. And so for a mind that is attached to and delighted by stimulation and attachment, this sitting and meditating and steadying the mind in the present moment, it loses its luster. It doesn't have any luster. But to the mind, there's no point in it. So I like to spin my talk giving you some reasons why you want to cultivate this ability to stay in the present moment. So first reason why is that we need to steady the mind. All of our difficulties, I hate to say it, comes from mind. It doesn't come from the actual difficulty. Like things happen to us, things that we don't like. It's just part of life. But every single one of us in this room have had enough difficulty in your life that you have lived through, even you online. We have all lived through difficulty. If I asked us to start telling the difficulties we've lived through, none of us would stop talking. We would all just be sitting here running down all the difficulties we've been through. And we're here, laughter, playing, still uplifted. So it's not the difficulties. It's that the mind doesn't like difficulties. And so it pushes us in directions to convince us that we could, unlike any other being in the world, we, you, me, I could avoid all difficulty if I just follow the mind. And so I do. We follow the mind thinking that somehow or another, if we follow the mind, we can fix things that went wrong. We can avoid things going wrong. And we keep getting caught in difficulties. But there is a way that the mind cannot tolerate discomfort. It cannot tolerate it. It thinks discomfort, unpleasantness means danger. It means something's wrong. It does not like the unknown. So if it doesn't know exactly what's happening or what's going to happen, it doesn't want to stay there. It has to be in habit, surety, and it has to be in pleasant. That's it. If it's not in that, everything else is dangerous. And so it projects that danger into your understanding. Not because it's right, just because it's confused, really. Because any one of us that have ever sat through some difficulty, the mind just kind of acquiesces. And it never says, oh, my bad, it wasn't that bad. I'm sorry, I thought that was going to be a monstrous thing, but it's not that bad. It doesn't ever say that. So it just gets reactive and impulsive. So if you want to live with a sense of well-being, you have to get this mind that's reactive to unpleasantness to settle down. You have to get it to settle down. It has to steady itself so that you can go through a life where you're going to have unpleasantness discomfort, difficulties, you're gonna have that. But when the mind gets overreactive about it, it makes the whole thing worse. And it's hard to manage it. So the more you cultivate concentration, the more the mind can learn how to be still, even when something is difficult. So you still have to deal with that difficulty. But dealing with difficulty with a still mind is very different than dealing with difficulty with a reactive mind. So we learn to still the mind just so we can be with life on life's terms without being tormented by a mind that's scared of everything. It might seem like you got to have some terrible thing happen during your sit in order to help that mind still itself during difficulties. Because some of the stuff we have to deal with in life is major difficulty. But as strange as it might seem, not scratching an itch will train the mind to be still with even losing your job. It's kind of weird, but the mind, if it learns to feel discomfort in any level with mindfulness, then it will apply that same mindfulness across the board on all difficulties. So even though most of us don't have earth-shaking things happening when we're meditating, that learning to still with just the irritation or the discomfort of the temperature, of a little pain, a sleepiness, whatever it is, that discomfort, learning to steady the mind in the midst of that is what enables you to be steady when life's craziness comes upon us. Because the mind learns that just because something is unpleasant doesn't mean danger. So we have to train the mind, and you train the mind to be with unpleasantness through concentration, through samadhi. So it doesn't mean this samadhi that's training this mind, it doesn't mean that you're kind of like easygoing when you're sitting there and you really want to scratch this itch, or there's some discomfort and you really want to move. You might move. It's not that. What it is this willingness to see unpleasantness as just unpleasant. That is a understanding that a still mind can begin to understand. It's just unpleasant. And the more you begin to sense it's just a sensation that's unpleasant, then the less you feel compelled, pushed by that unpleasantness to stop it or change it or fix it or make it different, make it otherwise. That's what we are trying to learn here. We're trying to learn how to train a mind that is intimidated by unpleasantness, learn how to be with unpleasantness and steady itself. At the same time, a mind that, if it feels something pleasant, takes ownership of it, we want that mind to not need to take ownership of it, to actually just appreciate the pleasantness of it and let it move on. That comes from meditation practice that's both sometimes good and sometimes not. Sometimes good, sometimes not. And that, sitting with a unpleasant sit is just as important a sitting with a pleasant sit. And somehow or another, we just learn to let the flow of the sits come and go. No matter what shows up, that we're going to allow it to be. What gave me the ability to steady my mind like that is that arriving sequence we did at the beginning of the meditation. This learning to arrive in whatever conditions you're sitting in. Just know where you're at, know what you're doing. And this being available, softening and being receptive so you can linger with whatever is present. And then having this alignment with your own Dhamma, the reason why you're doing this. So that you're not just sitting there, not scratching an itch, because Tuari said so. Don't do it for that reason. You actually want to see what happens if you don't scratch, and what happens if you do. So sometimes you may actually scratch the itch just to see what happens. But that willingness to hold both the pleasant and the unpleasant with the same kind of steadiness, that's what samadhi is doing. That's what samma, right samadhi, is doing. The second thing it's doing, so besides stilling the mind so you're not caught in this reactive mind that can get overwhelming, is you are cultivating appropriate attention. The Buddha said that there's no greater skill than the cultivation of appropriate attention for this, for cultivating wisdom and discernment. So we have to learn how to put our attention on what's appropriate. That's a kind of a roundabout way of saying, if you are caught in this reactive mind that's either caught in sleepiness or caught in restlessness or caught in some kind of irritation it doesn't like and resistant, or it wants something other than what's here, if you're caught in all that and the doubt that comes with all that, then you're putting your attention on that, trying to fix it, trying to change it. I cannot tell you how many times I would come out of a 40-minute sit, 10 minutes into it, and spend 20 minutes wishing the bell would come. It's not coming any sooner than 20 minutes, but I would sit there and just wallow in this wishing that the bell would ring, and how much longer is it going to be, and I've been here checking my watch and 1 minute has gone by, and that restlessness, this is inappropriate attention, because you're putting your attention on the reactivity, which is in effect giving that reactivity strength. It's strengthening. Whereas learning to put our attention on something neutral in the present moment is cultivating a neutral mind. And a neutral mind has some benefits that we're going to talk about in just a second. So when you put your attention on the breath, on sounds, on the sensation of the body's posture, but it's not just that. I mean, the Buddha listed 13 different aspects in the Satipatthana that you can put your attention on. You don't have to put your attention on the breath. You can put your attention on elements. You could put your attention on just imagining this is your last breath and you're about to die. There are 9 different death meditations. It's just a lot that you can put your attention on, but all of it, you hold it in this neutral kind of soft kind of attending to it, just interest in it, curiosity in it. That process of putting our attention on one of these satipatthanas and the different elements of the satipatthana, what you end up doing is getting the mind out of its story. You get the mind out of its story, and instead you put it on something that's real arising in this present moment. That's what you're doing. It is a distinction between lost in more delusion and cultivating this ability to be present with what's happening in the present moment. The thing that you're doing when you put your attention on present moment, what's arising, the satipatthana, are different meditative objects. When you put your attention on that versus putting your attention on the, yes, you can tell her to, you can tell her to be quiet. She's fine. I can see her. It's like, so when you put your attention on appropriate things, like the satipatthana, these things that the Buddha gave as objects of meditations are very neutral kinds of things. But in that neutrality, what you can see that you otherwise cannot see is conditionality. So that's what happens on retreats when people gradually, little bit by little bit by little bit, they steady their attention on some neutral object, some practice. It doesn't have to be long retreat either, just some time of extended sitting and walking and sitting and walking. You put your attention on something neutral. What rises is conditionality. You start seeing your habits. You just start seeing them, not because you're doing anything special, but because habits are so constant that even if you're on a retreat and you're not even at home, you still do the same habits. So as soon as you start cultivating this kind of extended attention on neutrality, what you begin to see is conditionality. And the gift of seeing conditionality is you also see the futility of that conditionality. You begin to see, why do I keep doing that? You can actually see, many of you know this, how tight you are. Like you keep bringing your shoulders up. You keep pushing in. You tighten your hands up and you're like, why am I doing that? I should stop. I'm just sitting here. But you can see how you tighten up, how you get tense. You can see how your thinking pattern is. You can see so much because your mind is focused on neutrality. And there is a whole nother mind that you have access to that is wisdom. It's not trapped in the reactivity. But you have to take this reactive mind and have it sit somewhere. So this mind that gets opened up, this discernment capacity of mind that gets opened up when the reactive mind is settled, It can penetrate anything. It can penetrate a moment in time, and you can understand exactly why you do something. You can understand why the lawfulness of things that happen, why you're getting reactive, what, I mean, everything. It's not a psychological understanding, like I understand why my parents were the way they were. It's not that. I don't think I'll ever understand why they were the way they were, but what I do understand is, because they were like this, I am like this. Because I was raised in this kind of a house, I now act this way. I can begin to see and understand the lawfulness of causes and conditions. And it's less personal. And if it's less personal, you don't have a kind of, I have to stay this way. You actually can begin to let go of habits because you no longer have that sense of ownership. Like, this is me. So if I let go of it, I'm somehow chopping off a limb. It's like letting go of your phone at a retreat. We never want to let go of them because it's like chopping off a limb. But if you let go of it, then when you get it back, you have a less kind of love for it. Sort of, you leave it in the box. And we have to make people take those phones because we don't want them. But that, this penetrative wisdom that we rarely get access to, that penetrative wisdom is the wisdom that can help you discern in any given moment what's the appropriate action to take. So you don't have to make yourself not be reactive. The mind chooses not to be reactive, just on its own choice. Doesn't have anything to do with you. In fact, you're kind of shocked that the mind did that. Like, how come I didn't lose it like I normally do? It just comes from this capacity of concentration, that the concentration, the learning to steady your attention in the present moment in meditation is helping the mind learn how to know what is appropriate and what is not in any given situation. Just that steadying the mind. And then the last thing I wanted to bring out is this, the mind becomes pliable. It becomes malleable. It is the nature of neuroplasticity that the mind can change and its understandings change. And it can see through delusion. It can see when the mind is deluded, when it can see itself, meaning it can see when it is deluded and when it is not. It can see and understand what is wisdom and what is not. So I want to sort of help you see how you can I want to give you an example from my childhood, from my life, how you can kind of see what it is that you're doing. So I used to move all the time, every year. Soon as that year ended, that year's lease, they're about to raise the rent, I would go find someplace cheaper than the place, than what it was going to cost me to stay there. So every year, I'm moving, and I'm a single parent with two little boys, and I have hundreds of books. I was, like, addicted to books and hundreds of books. So the first time I tried moving, I didn't catch or grasp how heavy boxes of books are. So I kind of put the books in these big boxes and nobody wanted to move those books. So of course the next year comes around and I got to move again and nobody really wants to come and move my books. And I told everybody, I got a plan for how I'm going to move the books. You don't have to move them. So here was my plan. I had the boys, they were young, they would move the books. And at first I just said, okay, I want you to take these books and I want you to take them to the car and put them in my car. And we're going to move all the big stuff. But they, like a normal mind, they started grabbing the books, competing with each other, running to the car, throwing the books in, running back to get some more. And before long, I realized at that rate, they were going to move the books quicker than we were going to be able to move the furniture. And that's not going to work. So I made them stop. And I went over and I grabbed the books and I showed them all the little words that people had to write in order for that book to be there. Went through this whole thing about how sacred these books are. This is sacred. This is a big deal. You can't just throw them in there. So we have to take all those books out of there, out of the car, put them back. You got to carry no more than two books at a time. Thaddeus could only carry one book. Raymond could carry two. Got to walk slowly to the car. You place it in the car. This whole system to slow them down so we could move all the other stuff. People would crack up watching these two boys carrying these books gently to the car and placing them in the car. I even made them have breaks and have a snack break, a lunch break. Like, do not, no rushing. The boys never got in the way when we were moving. Never. They were always attentive to their books. This is what you have to do with the mind. The mind has to get interested in something simple, something sacred. The breath is not just some boring thing. It is important. It's sacred that the mind can rest its attention on and begin to take care with steady, 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 and then this whole other mind can open up. But if you spend your whole sit dwelling on all the things that a reactive mind wants to get entangled with, you never get to access this other mind that we all have. It's not some minds have it, all minds have it. But it is not going to sort of express itself until this mind quiets down. So it's got to move the books in a sacred, careful way all the way to the car and take its time. That's what we're doing. And then you cultivate a completely different capacity. You don't even know where it comes from. You're not cultivating the awakening of this discerning mind. You don't have to. That's what I learned from Philip. It naturally arises. If you can cultivate this reactive mind to steady itself, to settle down, to learn to just stay present with whatever's arising in a soft, kind of careful way. And even when Raymond would convince me he could carry three books, he didn't understand why he had to carry two. It was the timing. So I would say, no, I don't know if you're ready for three books. Just stick with the two books. He's saying, no, look, these are three small books. I could carry those. I'm like, I don't know. You better stick with just two. Leave the small books for Thaddeus to carry, and you carry just two books, because I don't know. That's asking a lot. But it got them to settle down, not run underfoot, not get in the way, and we could move all the other stuff. And the whole move would be, a couple hours. No big deal. I never had any trouble getting anyone to come help me move. I think they came just to watch Raymond and Thaddeus carry the books, but they could have came to help me. So this is why concentration is important. Samadhi is important. It's important to cultivate it, to learn to cultivate it, to take that instruction to return again and again and again, seriously, to actually get interested in breath or elements or whatever it is that sounds, whatever anchor you want to practice with, to practice learning how to get interested in that and steady your attention there. Because without it, you don't get the access to the mind that really is liberating. And we end up living within this reactive, childlike mind that's scared of everything. And that's the torment. So I think this liberation that the Buddha was pointing to is not that we no longer have any bad things happening, but the mind that we are addressing our lives with is this wisdom mind and not this childlike mind that is afraid of everything. So let's just sit here for a minute and then we'll see if you guys have anything you want to talk about or share or ask before we part ways. Thank you so much for your kind attention. Appreciate it. So let's see if there's something that someone has, anybody that wants to ask a question or share a comment or anything. I really am interested in your difficulties with concentration. We might talk more about this next week, why it gets difficult and how to deal with the difficulties of trying to cultivate this concentrated mind. But today, I just wanted to inspire you to look after it. All right, let's do the in here first, and then we'll see if we can get the online person.
So I guess I've got a two-part question.
Sure.
One would be, do you think you need an object to direct your concentration to? And the second part of that, which I think is related, is what would you say to someone who struggles with objects sort of disappearing, or like whatever object I choose to be like sacred, so to speak, to use your terminology,
yeah,
sort of like nullifies it. It becomes the most neutral and like least interesting thing. And so if I choose the breath, suddenly I'm more aware of the body, like, and vice versa. And it's something I've struggled with for a while and haven't really been able to wrap my practice around that in a way that's been helpful.
So have you ever tried just attention in the present moment?
I have, yeah.
And what about that?
It can work, but often without something to stay interested in. Personally, I will just get sleepy and kind of zone out a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And then if you do find an object that, let's say the breath, I think the breath might be too subtle, but let's say you use the breath. What happens if the mind goes to the body? What do you do?
Typically, I try to roll with it and just say, okay, it's something else to be aware of.
And do you go back to the breath?
I do. I try to let like the attention rest on the body for a little bit and mm-hmm. then try to at some point pull it back.
Okay. And when you're resting on the breath, is it the felt sense of the breath? Feel the body breathing?
Yeah, it's like mm-hmm. usually I've tried different areas, but usually like at my nose. And I find it to be very subtle. Like sometimes I'm like, am I even feeling it?
But yes, it is very subtle.
I'm going mm-hmm. for the felt sense at least.
Yeah. The breath at the nose is a little different than the breath in the belly or the chest. The breath at the nose is more conceptual than it is felt sense. It's very hard to feel it. And you have to be willing to hold your attention at this point, whether you feel it or not. So your attention is what is being held there. Not, you may not feel the actual breath. You hold your attention there. And as you hold your attention there, softly, not by force, soft, then it will get very, 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 very noticeable. So what's probably happening is you stop feeling the breath there, and so your attention goes away. But you keep your attention there. The way Bhante Buddharakhita taught me was, think of yourself as a gatekeeper. When you're holding when your attention, if you're going to use the nose as your object, you're a gatekeeper. So your attention is right here. Like the example they give is right at the point where the saw crosses. Right there. That's where you want to keep your attention. You don't want to go wherever the saw goes, and you don't want to go back. So you don't care. He called it a gatekeeper. That was the most helpful thing anyone had ever said. You're just standing at the gate. You don't care who's going in or who they're going to go see. You don't care who's coming out and where they're going. You just stand right there at the gate. It's a noble job. It's an honorable job. You're just there at the gate. And you just watch the people coming and going at the gate. So the point of the breath at the nostrils is the attention on that spot. Do you see the difference? When it's in the belly or when it's in the chest, you can feel the arising and falling of the chest or the expanding of the belly. But when it's at the nose, it has to be just the attention on the spot on the nose of where you have your attention. And that's it. You're just the gatekeeper right there. And sometimes nobody's coming and going, right? But you still have to keep your attention right there. So that's why I was asking you if you just do the present moment, is because in order for you to be with the nostril as a concentration object, you have to be willing to just steady your attention right there at that spot. And the sensations of breathing there will come and go, come and go, come and go.
Yeah, I guess I struggle when they go. Like, if they're not there, I kind of don't know what to do with that.
Right. Because if you're trying to sense it, then when it goes, you're like, oh, what do I sense? But that's not what you're doing. You're putting your attention right here, just the attention. So another way to say it is your nose part is never going anywhere. It's still there. So you just keep your attention right on that spot. Whether you feel it or not, it doesn't matter. You just keep your attention there. And ultimately, as you keep your attention on that spot, then the sensation will come back. But if you move your attention away from it, then that's such a subtle spot, it's very hard to cultivate it back again. So keep your attention there. The mind might go off. or the sensation of it will go away, but it'll come back.
Cool. That I'll experiment with that. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay, I guess people can unmute now. All right, so anything else? Anybody else? Yeah.
Okay, so I've been meditating for a very long time now, and I struggle a lot with finding interest. I think I'm okay with just sitting through, even with frustration or discomfort, but I don't think I've ever found interest or the concentration the way you are describing it, mm-hmm. which is not brute forcing my way, but rather getting absorbed from interest.
What object do you use?
Almost always breath.
You use breath.
And then sounds if I get distracted, but then mostly it's just breath always.
Mostly breath. And is it at the nose or is it at the chest or belly?
All of it. From
whole body breathing.
Yeah, all the way from nostrils to the belly and diaphragm. And yeah.
Whole body breathing. Mm-hmm. And then how natural does the breath feel? Does it feel, do you ever let go of, do you ever feel the sensation of having to let go of the breath? Or do you feel like you're breathing in, breathing out, breathing in?
Do you mean like the conscious control?
Yeah.
Yeah. After the initial few minutes, I lose conscious control. I just observe.
Yes, so you just observe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. After a few minutes, it happens. Mm-hmm. But then I don't know if that's concentration or if...
That's getting concentrated. That's part of getting concentrated.
Okay.
You're no longer... It's the same on the nostril, except you don't feel anything.
But
you have to let go of actually breathing and let the body just breathe.
But that doesn't seem interesting, though. I still feel a little bit of frustration.
It isn't. It's moving the books. Okay. So
I'm still waiting for the insight.
There are some ways to get interested in the breath, right? So first of all, do you ever notice when the breath comes in? Right? Do you notice that you're breathing, or do you notice that the body actually takes an in-breath in? So you're there when the in-breath is coming, you're there when it's in the middle, and you're there when it leaves. Because the body stops breathing, and it doesn't breathe rhythmically. So sometimes it'll take an in-breath, and then another in-breath, and then another, and then out, and then an in, and then a long out. It doesn't breathe in this kind of rhythmical way, but your mind thinks it's very rhythmical. In, out, in, out, in, out. There's nothing here. I know what a breath is. In, out, in, out. That's not what's actually happening in real breathing. It gets very staccato. Sometimes it's like panting. It's rarely long, and it doesn't have a rhythm to it like that. And so when you start getting interested in just what the out breaths feel like, just that, don't care about the in breath, just care about the out breaths. I want to know that the breath is gone, it's out. And then I want to know, watch it. Out, out, out. Then I want to watch it in. Know it's coming in. And then see the gap in between the two and the middle. So that's how you get interested in the breath. Like beginning to actually notice how the body is breathing. And the more you notice how the body is breathing, you can begin to feel this kind of pressure that the body will stop breathing. It doesn't stop breathing, but we don't know how much we control the body breathing. And when we just watch it, then we begin to see that it's not as rhythmical as we think. That's what makes it interesting. And then this sense of the body breathing and you're not making it breathe can be freeing. Like, oh my God, this body is breathing itself. It's not even me breathing it. And when did that happen? And that is when you have this kind of experience of what people will call the beautiful breath, because you begin to realize this body is breathing itself. And I'm alive. I'm not doing anything. But to get there, you have to be interested in how the body breathes and be present to the in-breath that comes in and the middle of that breath and the end of it. And then notice the shift when the body stops breathing before it starts breathing again. So there's this process that actually happens with breathing, which is why I think the Buddha pointed to the breath and the Satipatthana, because it isn't as smooth as we think it is. The body's fine. It's not upset. But if the mind actually saw how the body was breathing, then it would get freaked out about what is it doing. It should be breathing more. Why is it taking an out-breath? It just took an out-breath. Why is it doing another one? But it has something to do with the body's processing air. And so it knows when it needs to take two out-breaths and two in-breaths. You see? So what you're getting bored about is that you're thinking about breathing, and the mind makes it very rhythmical, and it's just like this, every in, out, in, out, in, out, in, out. But that's really you controlling the breathing. And so to begin to quiet that down some, you can just notice the out-breaths, or just notice the in-breaths, or just see if you can watch the breath from the in all the way through. And if you don't catch it, you just notice you're breathing, that's fine. Try it again. Just keep doing it until you get to, you begin to see the whole breath all the way from the beginning, the middle, the end. Stop, and then it'll do something else. You see? That's how you start getting interested.
Sure. Thank you. I'll try harder.
Okay, you try that. We'll see what happens next week when I come back. behind you. You guys online okay? Doing okay? Okay. Good.
Hi, Tori.
Hi.
Lucy over here.
Good.
I have a really hard time with breath as an anchor for myself. It's like a heart palpitations. Then I've had shortness of breath in my life. So I just have to try to never pay attention to my breathing.
Yes.
That's what works better for me. So I usually try to use body sensation as an anchor, but I just don't feel like I've gotten that much guidance about it. And what I end up feeling like happens is I end up focusing on difficult sensations in the body. And I was wondering if you could talk some about that.
So I think if you're going to use sensations, the breath is in there. So that's part of, that might be some of what makes it difficult, is the breath is part of that whole process. And a lot of the sensations are coming from the breath's inhale that nourishes all the cells and everything. Or it could be digestion or something like that. All of our little systems that are going on all the time doing their repair. So the thing about sensations in the body is you want to sense into the aliveness of it, like the present moment movement of the body. So movement of sensations, movement of systems in the body, and pay attention to that movement of it. Because the more you pay attention to the movement, not the thing, right? Because unpleasantness is a thing. So there might be sensations in your knee or sensations in your back, but if you're thinking about the unpleasantness of it, you're dwelling on my back is unpleasant. And that's a thought. And that's what we're trying to get out of. That's how you get into this wisdom mind, is you get out of thinking. Is that water? Oh, yeah, they're really going to have some problems with some leaks. The more you get out of the lost in the what has the sensation, what part of your body has got a sensation, and is it pleasant or unpleasant, that kind of sensory connection, that's part of the problem, is that that's what the thinking is. So you want to feel the sensations just as sensation. That's movement. That's what you want to begin to feel. It's just the movement. And I always found that the best way to sense that movement is to sense it against the backdrop of your body not moving. Do you see the difference? So you have to have a backdrop that's still and steady. So your body is here, still steady. Notice that your legs are not moving or your arms are not moving. And I think then you can feel the sensory experience much more pronounced than if you are ignoring the fact that you're sitting and just trying to focus on the sensations. You need the backdrop of that stillness in order for the movement to make sense. Do you see? So every once in a while, turn your attention to just the body's stillness itself, just sitting here. And then you'll begin to feel it's relatively still. And then you can start feeling the sensations moving again. And that's what you're feeling. But you don't care what those sensations are. You don't care if it's a sensation of your feet. It's not your feet anyway. It's just tingling. And have that sensation feel more descriptive, not your hands, not your feet, but just tingling, pulsing, you know, kind of pressure, swirling, that kind of, do you see what I'm saying? So come up with words that are descriptive of the sensation and note them, and not where the sensation is. You don't really care. And then you can, because the body is constantly moving all the time, it will never stop. It ebbs and flows. So the ebb and flow, just like with sound, will change. But there's always some sensory aliveness happening, changing, swirling, going on, that you can stay with it. As long as you take it out of, this is my back, this is my foot, my hands, or have the backdrop of the body sitting still, so that you know you're sitting, feeling this movement. Do you see? I think that will help.
That's helpful. I appreciate you.
Yeah. Here's down front. This will be maybe the last one. We'll see. That's okay.
Okay. All right. So I'm thinking, like, how do we do this out in the world?
How do you do it out in the world?
How do we do this out in the world?
You don't need to do it out in the world.
No.
You need to do it on the cushion. Mm-hmm. And the body, the mind. So think of it like this. If you get a puppy and you don't want the puppy to pee in the house, you're going to have to train the puppy. You're going to have to train it. Mm-hmm. But once that puppy's trained, he's not peeing in the house unless he's old. Or she's old, she can't help it. But once they're trained, it knows what to do. It knows how to hold it, even if you have to stay at work a little longer. It might be right there at the door, like, let's go. Let's don't put your stuff down. We ain't got time for all that. But it knows how to be in the world pee outside. So that's what you're doing. You're training your mind how to exist in the world, how to exist in a world that's full of greed, hatred, and delusion, and not get overwhelmed by it. But you do that sitting on the cushion, being with a mind that doesn't want to sit there, that is irritated, that is sleepy, restless, want something else. All those hindrances are there, and you sit there and be with that. That seems like it's no big deal. But if you learn to steady your mind with that, that's the exact same thing you're going to feel as soon as you get up and go to the grocery store. And the mind knows how to do it because you train it when you're sitting on the cushion. You see, so it's not that you don't need to be out in the world and deal with the world. But that's not what meditation's for. Meditation is to train your mind on how to settle down so that the wisdom mind is the mind that's relating with the world, not your reactive mind.
Yeah, maybe it's that overwhelm. Like, but it's my mind doing that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you want that overwhelm to show up when you're meditating. Because mm-hmm. if you're going to practice with it, right, you can't practice with overwhelm when you're out in the world overwhelmed.
Right.
That's not, you can't do it. But when you're just sitting there, nothing's happening. Nobody's around you. You're just sitting there and the mind's overwhelmed. Like, okay, well, thank you. We'll see what, how do we settle down when we have overwhelm when we're sitting on the cushion? That's the best time to practice with it. Because nothing's happening. Mm-hmm. And so you can sit there and keep coming back to an anchor. I don't care how often you have to do it. It doesn't really matter. Because you're practicing, you're training the mind how to be relaxed in an overwhelmed situation. And the mind will learn it. You know, like puppies are going to pee on the floor and you're going to have to clean it up. But eventually they will figure it out and they learn how to do it. And the mind, as overwhelmed as it might be, it will figure out how to get still. And then you'll be out in the world overwhelmed and it will drop down into stillness because you've practiced it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
Thank you. Until now, the meditation practice we used to the internal aggregates. And my question is, when we deal with the external world, when interact with other people or some other atoms, and what is a good practice to set up a concentration? Should we set it the concentration still on ourselves, or we should give it to? Set it to others.
I think what I think ends up happening is the more you have to be willing to practice with reactivity when you're meditating. So you have to let the mind, you can't be intimidated by the mind's reactivity when it's sitting there. Because the difficulty with dealing with other people is we get very reactive and it bothers us what they do. But we have to learn how to be with that reactivity so that we don't react out in the world in a way that we don't want to react. And the best way to practice that is when you're meditating. So even though it seems like you're meditating internally when you're sitting by yourself, what you're actually doing is training the mind on how to be in relation to external things when you're out and about. It just seems like it's very internal, but it's because I think that's why I think the hindrances, which is what we're going to talk about next week, why these hindrances are such a gift when we're practicing. We need them to show up. Because if you don't have, if you don't have sleepiness, so all the ones that we're talking about, I can't stay with my practice. It's no difference than not being able to stay with your anchor than sleepiness. You don't feel sleepy, but you're bored as hell. And that boredom, sleepiness, is something you have to practice with so that you learn how to get interested in the present moment. And that will carry into your being able to stay in the present moment, even when you're in, you know, situations where you're not really interested. You'll still be able to stay at work and show up for meetings that you're not really interested in. You see? So that's, it's a skill that we have to sort of learn. And I don't know that householders get how important that skill is for us, especially us, because we are practitioners who don't live in homeless lives. We don't live in the holy life. And because we don't, we are constantly being bombarded by things that go against our practice. And so we have to learn how to steady our minds in the midst of that. It's different when you're on retreat. Even though you have all these difficulties, it still feels kind of cocoony, kind of safe and protected. And then you have to go out in the world. As householders, we don't live a monastic life. But we have to cultivate the same skills that monastics cultivate because we need it when we go out in the world and deal with other people.
Very simple. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. All right, so it's time for us to end. I appreciate you being here. Next week we're going to talk about how, you know, a little bit of love for the difficulties that show up in practice because we need it. Better it show up in practice than it shows up just out in our lives. All right, so thank you for being here. Do continue to support Seattle Insight. We really need your support and we want to stay here and we want to stay going. So all the support, you know, it just comes from Donna. It doesn't really come from any kind of membership or any kind of required amount. You give whatever you can. Don't worry about it. And together we will continue going another 40 years. We've got two down. We just have 38 more to go. All right, good. All right, thank you so much for being here.